This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Jerry Clinton again, and I want to thank you for showing up for Night Transmissions number 116. Here at the top, I do want to mention that I'm going to take a couple of weeks off, so there won't be a show for Christmas week or New Year's week. I will post a couple of repeats from a couple of years ago, but that's next week. So this week we're going to start off with an episode of Murder by Experts from July the 18th of 1949. This was a show that was created by David Kogan, who's well remembered in old-time radio circles for The Mysterious Traveler and The Strange Dr. Weird, and if not countless, at least numerous numbers of other radio programs dotting the landscape of the radio's golden age. There were 130 episodes, of which only a handful have survived. This show revolves around the premise that each week a mystery guest writer would select a story from another writer. Yeah, as in, not their own work, to be presented as that week's show. Sometimes at the end of the show, I guess as time permitted, there would be a critical post-mortem of the episode, sometimes featuring well-known personalities. Tonight's episode is The Creeper, which is a suspenseful story about a mad killer who strangles red-headed victims. It should be said, I suppose, as an article of interest, that The Creeper is an episode of old-time radio that was broadcast on at least four separate programs. Murder by Expert, of course, The Chase, and The Molly Mystery Theater, as well as Murder at Midnight, which I played quite some time ago.
Murder by Experts. The Mutual Broadcasting System presents Murder by Experts with your host and narrator, Mr. John Dixon Carr, world-famous mystery novelist and author of the recently published bestseller, The Life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
This is John Dixon Carr. Each week at this time, Murder by Experts brings you a story of crime and mystery which has been chosen for your approval by one of the world's leading detective writers, those experts who are themselves masters of the art of murder and can hold tensity at its highest. This time, our guest expert is the noted mystery novelist, Lawrence Brockman. For his vast knowledge of the mystery field, Mr. Brockman has chosen a radio classic written by Joseph Roscoe. And now we present Miss Marilyn Erskine in The Creeper. It is the hour before dawn. That moment when the huge, sprawling metropolis lies deep in slumber. The streets are empty, save for the milkman making his rounds from one darkened apartment house to another. But look now, there on the third floor, an apartment is brightly lighted. The occupant is an attractive redhead in her early 20s. She sits curled on a couch, speaking on the telephone as the radio plays soft.
Like I'm telling you, Gladys, I'm waiting on my table, paying no attention to this guy. I can see, of course, that he's giving me the eye, but good.
What did he look like?
Oh, he was the Gary Cooper type. Tall, lanky, and sunburned, bashful, too. Anyway, he's sitting at one of my tables, trying to get up nerve enough to start a conversation. I'm polite, but nothing else. Well, it's 2 a.m., and we're getting ready to close the place. And he finally speaks his piece.
What did he say, Virginia? What did he say?
Oh, that he was from out of town, and this was his first visit to New York. And, oh,
And what? And what, Ginny?
Gladys, I think somebody's trying to get into my apartment.
What?
Yeah, the doorknob is turning.
Oh, it's probably some drunk got the wrong apartment.
Oh, he's putting a key in the lock right now.
So what? You've got your night lock on, haven't you?
No, it's broken. Gladys, I'm scared.
There's nothing to worry about. He'll go away when he finds his key won't unlock the door.
Gladys, the door is opening. What do you want? You've got the wrong apartment.
Ginny, what is it? Answer me.
Get out of here. Get out of here, I'll scream.
Ginny.
No. No, stay away from me. Stay away from me.
Ginny! New York. The unknown killer, called the Creeper, has struck again, adding a third female victim to his toll. Virginia Peters, a comely waitress, was found strangled to death in her third-floor apartment early this morning while her radio blared. As in the previous murders, a note was found scrawled on the wall with the victim's lipstick and the plea, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." Police insist that...
Oh, how awful, how awful. And in this very neighborhood.
Why'd you turn it off?
Because I can't stand to hear about it. How can you go out eating without batting an eye?
No, let's hear the rest. Interesting.
Oh, you. Don't go turning on that radio again, Steve Brandt. I've heard enough. I'll go out of my mind, for heaven's sake.
Yes. That's a good, solid clue.
What is?
For heaven's sake. How many men use that expert?
Oh, shut up.
Okay, Mrs. Grant. Pass the biscuits, my little pigeon.
Pass the biscuits. Eat, eat, eat. Three women in 3 days murdered in cold blood by a fiend right here in the Heights. I'm too sick to go out. Too scared to stay in. The lock's broken, and he sits there eating. Pass the biscuits, he said.
Well, there's nothing wrong with my appetite, my love.
Of course. That's what cost you your job on the police force. You were in a restaurant eating when you should have been answering a call.
Well, some men drink to escape. I eat.
Escape what? What?
An ugly tongue, a beautiful face, and a roving eye. In short, a wife.
Oh, so you're starting that again. You and your crazy jealousy.
Maybe the Creeper's way of escaping life isn't drinking or eating, but strangulation. Who knows?
Shut up. Go ahead and get a divorce. Go ahead. Can I help it if men look at me? I don't know why you come home at all. Where do you go? What do you do with yourself? Where were you this morning? Why did you come back?
To eat. But someday I'll lose my appetite for that, too. And when I do, honey, there'll be no escape. Now, I'm off again. Kiss? Yeah. Still using stage lipstick, huh? Wipe it off. How many times must I tell you? You're married now, remember?
Steve, wait.
Yeah?
At least... Go buy me my medicine.
Sorry, no time.
Don't leave me alone. Stay home today, please. I'm afraid.
Oh, don't be silly. That nothing will happen to you. You have a doorman, an elevator boy, Mrs. Stone across the hall, a phone. Oh, you're safe.
But the night lock, it doesn't work.
Well, now you can't lock me out anymore.
It doesn't catch. Something's happened to it since last night. Steve.
Get a new one.
I can't get a locksmith. They're all so busy. I've tried all morning. Steve, please. If I want to phone you, where will you be?
Out. Goodbye, love. Take care of your cold. Steve Grant.
Why, if it isn't old Pearly Chase.
Yeah, here you got thrown off the force, Steve.
Yeah. You got thrown off the news, Pearly.
Yeah, you heard wrong. I wasn't fired. I was just warned.
I wasn't fired either. Just suspended. For 3 days. My trouble is I eat too much.
I drink too much. I hear you living up at the Heights, Steve.
Yeah.
It's funny, me too. Hear you're married now to a gal that's a knockout. That's all the boys whistling.
Yeah, you can say that again. Used to be on the stage, you know.
Yeah, I think I knew her. Wasn't her stage name Vicky Duval?
That's her. I love that wench, but... women. How does a guy handle them? Maybe the creeper has the right method.
Thank you for taking the words out of my mouth. Who is the creeper, Steve? You got any angle?
Well, you tell me and I'll split the reward with you.
One thing, though, and I don't think even the police force have put it together yet.
Yeah?
In all three cases, just before the creeper struck, the door locks had already been tampered with.
You don't say.
You got a theory?
Well, sure. I mean, take that note on the wall written with lipstick. For heaven's sake, in every case, for heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more.
I cannot control myself.
Right. Now, what man uses an expression like that? The long and short of it is this. A creeper is a woman.
A ruse. Just like the height of the message from the floor is a ruse. 6 feet. And yet I'll lay odds the creeper's no more than a guy your height, say. Or mine. 5'9".
Eh? Well, go on. Let's have the rest, Sherlock.
Okay. That business of the three locks that were tampered with. They were tampered with from the inside.
I don't get it.
The creeper must have gotten into each of the apartments when no one was home and broken the night locks. That made it an easy setup when he came back later to knock off his victim.
Well, how could he have gotten in to begin with? Those were solid locks.
A picklock would open them.
You mean the creeper's a burglar?
Maybe. Oh, well.
Oh, nuts, you and your theory.
Yeah? How do I know where the creeper's going to strike next?
You do?
Certain. The creeper's not smart. He's just crazy. You play along crazy. Think the way he does. And you're one jump ahead of him. That's the trouble with the police. No imagination. How can you expect logical clues from a madman? Play along crazy, Steve. Make out you're the creeper. What's your compulsion?
Go ahead, let's see.
All right. First, the victims are all redheads, every one. You noticed that, of course. 3 redheads in 3 days.
Well, come to think of it, now that you mention...
Yeah, they all lived in the Heights, right? Rita Corkins, Claire Nixon, and Virginia Peters.
Right.
What was the number of the apartment in each case, huh? Rita lived in 1A. Claire, 2B. Virginia, 3C. Don't ask me the why or where, or don't ask me the logic. Just play along crazy. You see what I mean. You'll see where he's going to strike next.
I don't get what you mean.
The next victim of the creeper lives in the Heights. She's a redhead. Her night lock's been tampered with. She's gonna get hers today and her apartment number's 4D. Well, why are you staring at me? You don't like my arithmetic? Why are you staring?
My wife's a redhead, Clay. We live on the Heights. Our apartment number's... Ah, you're just a boozy reporter.
And your apartment number?
4D, I told you.
4D, of course. I'll have it delivered. Apartment 4D, I should have guessed it anyway.
Why?
A face is a number. Believe me, since you've moved into the neighborhood, Mrs. Grant, for me it has a special number. Like a double, dandy, delicious dream. 4Ds, you see?
Go on, I'll bet you tell that to every customer. Female.
I'm a ladies' man, like the creeper.
Oh.
What did I say? What's going on in this block? Raw nerves, you can't joke. The creeper, that's all I hear all day. Why, it's mass hysteria. There ain't no such an animal.
You don't think so?
Why, I assure you, Mrs. Grant, it's a fairy tale for circulation of the tabloids. I'll send your prescription up to the board.
No, I'll just wait here for it.
Well, it'll take some time. You should go right home and stay there if you're just getting over the flu. Now, believe me. I'll deliver it myself. It'll be a pleasure.
No, I'll wait. I may not go right back. I don't want to be there all alone. I'm afraid.
Well, suit yourself, Mrs. Grant.
Why are you staring at me?
I was admiring your lipstick. I've nothing like that in style.
It's a special lipstick. I used it when I was on the stage.
Well, don't let the creeper go writing a note with your lipstick. Have a seat. For heaven's sake, stop me before I kill more. I cannot control... Wait. What? That was a note I had reference to. It was a joke, that's all. Wait, Mrs. Grant, your prescription.
Mrs. Grant! Oh, it's you, Mr. Sybil.
What's your hurry, dear?
I just got such a scare. Since all these awful murders in this neighborhood.
Oh, yes. Isn't it terrible? You walking home?
I guess so.
I'll go with you. It's good we live in the same house.
At least if I had a double lock. But the night one doesn't work. I can't get a locksmith. They're all so busy.
Oh, don't you worry. We'll stay together this afternoon till our husbands come home.
Think of it. We've never visited, so we live right across the hall from each other. Isn't that just like a big city, for heaven's sake?
Or would you rather I dropped in on you?
Well, I don't...
I'll make it yours, then. Isn't it horrible, the ghastly things they're saying? The theories. One doesn't know what to think next. You believe the latest?
The latest?
That maybe it's a woman, the creeper.
A woman?
Can you beat it? I can't imagine how in the world the police figure that, for heaven's sake. Can you?
Oh, I don't know. I was just thinking of something my husband said.
Though I can see we're a married woman now, if her husband were two-timing her, say. Perhaps only weak and no will of his own. And if the wife, say, was merely getting at those female homebreakers, well, I can understand that. Because you take my husband now. You've met Mr. Stone, haven't you? Well, Mrs. Grant, why on earth are you staring at me like that, for heaven's sake?
I don't feel well. I must get home at once. I feel faint.
But Mrs. Grant, for heaven's sake.
Good afternoon, ma'am. I was shopping.
Oh. I guess it's you, Donald.
Just spilling Charlie. He's fixing the fuse box. Help you with your packages?
No, thank you.
Well, I don't mind a bit. You look out of breath.
I can manage. Where's Jimmy, the elevator boy?
He stepped out for a few minutes. I'll take you up.
But I...
He mightn't be back for another 5-10 minutes. No point you're waiting for him.
No, I suppose not.
Apartment 4D, eh?
Why, yes, how did you know?
Well, doesn't take long.
Funny that both Charlie and Jimmy should go off, leaving you to run things alone. Particularly seeing you new.
Oh, I don't mind. The last place I worked, I was the only man.
Where was that?
522 Smedley Avenue.
522 Smedley Avenue?
Yes. Right next door to the apartment house where the creeper strangled Frida Corcus. Suppose you, read about it.
Yes. What's wrong? Why'd you stop?
Wait. We seem to be stuck.
Start this elevator at once.
No need to get excited, Mrs. Grant. Take it easy. You live long. Can't figure what went wrong.
You don't fool me, not for a minute. I'll scream if you don't.
Oh, there we are. There, Charlie must have cut off the current.
Let me off.
Here we are. Want me to help you with your package?
No. I must be going out of my mind. My key. Where's my key? Oh, the darn lock. Hello? Is the locksmith in yet? I want to know how soon I can get my lock changed. Yes, of course I left my order. But he promised to fix it at once. No, I can't wait. I'm scared to death.
Hello, Vicky. Don't, you little fool. It's me. You want the whole house? To... That's better.
What are you doing here, Bernie?
I'm playing along crazy.
What are you talking about? How did you get in here?
Alias Pearlie Valentine. Don't worry. You haven't a thing to be upset about now. I've come to protect you. Give me the phone. Hello? Never mind about the lock, thank you. Long time no see, Vicky.
What do you want, Pearlie?
Me? A headline. Your husband wants, too. He wants I should keep an eye on you.
What's that?
Sure. You didn't think Steve and I were acquainted, did you? Oh, yeah, yeah. From way back. Just met him at a bar.
I don't believe you. What do you mean, keep an eye on me?
Oh, just in case the creep.
Oh!
You heard the character.
You're mad. You've always been mad, Pearlie Chase. Where is Steve? Why should he send you? Why should he think the creeper will come here? What are you doing here?
I told you. Playing along crazy. Got a drink?
You're drunk now. You're getting right out of here. You're nothing but a no-good rummy.
And you're nothing but a no-good. You finish it. When I took the drink, it was to forget you, and you know it. Well, Rumpot Angel. Which means I haven't gotten over you. Yet.
Get out.
You little two-timing redhead. Now you're all the same, you redheads.
Why, you...
Haven't changed, have you? Even a wedding ring can't do that to you. Ah, don't play the innocent. My business is snooping. I make a living at it. Between drinks. So your new motto's love thy neighbor, huh? Mr. Stone across the hall. Dumb Steve.
You dirty snooper.
Sit down, darling. Just play along with me while I play along crazy. Sit down. Yeah, like we're expecting company. I must be crazy doing this. Why wait here for the creeper? Why not 100 other streets, 1,000 other apartments, 1,000,000 other dames? Because I'm riding my hunch. Yeah, let's have some music. Don't just sit. Let's have some music. Turn on the radio. Let's dance. It's been a long time, baby. A long time. That's it. Now let's dance. Give me your arm. Let's dance. Yeah. Like old times. Around and around. Like my brain. Why are you trembling? I still love you, you little fool. Ask me why. I love you. I love you. I love you, redhead. I could kill you and you deserve it. With the radio on, you could scream and no one would hear. I could put my hand on your throat like this, and I could strangle you. Why are you crying? Stop it. I'm here to protect you. Stop crying. Cut it out. I say cut it out. I can't stand it. I never could. Okay, you want me to leave? All right, I will. It's your funeral. What am I saving you for anyway? Where's my hat? In a few minutes. There'll be a knock or a ring, or the door will just open. And you'll be lying on the floor like the other three. Your face black, your eyes bulging. Goodbye, my worthless. Give my regards to the creeper.
Oh, that look in his eyes. Like a madman. What if he comes back? He wants to kill me. Wants to kill me. Someone wants to kill me. Oh, I must lie down. My head. My sweating head. Trying to frighten you. Jealous. Fight, that's it. I'm like the other three. My face black. Like the other three. Like the other three any minute now. There'll be a knock. Or a ring. Yes?
Dorman, Mrs. Grant.
Yes?
The druggist is here with the medicine. Shall I let him up?
My medicine? Why, yes. No. No, don't let that man up.
Want me to bring it up?
No, I'm perfectly all right. I don't need it. You hear? Don't you dare come up. Don't anyone. Hello? I called just a few minutes ago. Please, I must have it changed right away. My lock, my door lock, yes. This is Mrs. Brand. Yes, I do want it, of course. Anyone can get in, anyone. You'll come right away? Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, but hurry, please. Hurry or I'll go out of my mind. Oh, thank the Lord. Thank the Lord. Like the other three. Strangled. Any minute now. A knock. Oh, ring. Oh. Who's there?
It's me, dear. Mrs. Stone.
What do you want?
Well, I've been worried about you. Are you ill?
No, I'm all right, Mrs. Stone. I'm feeling fine.
Open up, dear. Don't you want me to keep you company?
No, thank you. I was just... Oh, stop it!
Oh, do let me in, silly.
No, go away. I'm going to sleep. Please go away. Do you hear me? Go away. Hello.
Hello, Vicky. Are you all right?
Oh, Steve, I've been frantic. It's so good to hear your voice. Where are you?
At headquarters. I'm coming right home. Sweetheart, is anything wrong? You sound kind of funny.
No, not now. Not when I hear you, Steve. I don't know what came over me. All day I've been imagining things so silly. My nerves...
Forgive me for this morning, darling. I wasn't myself. My job had me down, but now everything's okay.
Forgive me, Steve. I've been bad, bad, wicked. Oh, you knew what I've gone through today. The most dreadful state. And then that... Steve, did you send someone here today?
Early Chase?
Then you did.
To keep you company. Isn't he still with you?
Why, no, I just got rid of him.
Oh, I wish you hadn't. He's an all right guy, smart reporter. Lives in the neighborhood, too. Honey, it sounds cockeyed. I mean, Pearlie's theory, but I was a bit worried when I got to thinking, so... Vicky, don't let anyone in the house till I get home.
I won't, Steve.
Not anyone, do you hear? Not anyone.
Locksmith.
Oh, wait, Steve.
Locksmith.
Oh, wait, Steve. Oh, thank goodness at last. Now I can breathe easy. Just a minute, dear.
Vicky. Hello. Hello, Vicky.
Mr.
You hear
Frank?
Me?
Yes, Mr. Frank.
Oh, thank goodness you've come. Please step in. It's the lock on this door that I... Oh, just a moment. My husband's on the phone. Steve?
Hey, what happened? There was something else I wanted to tell you.
It's all right. Everything's all right now, Steve. You needn't worry.
Well, didn't I just hear you talking to someone? Was that someone at the door?
It was no one, Steve. Just Mr. Frank, the locksmith, here to fix the lock. Oh, what a load off
the locksmith? Listen, Vicky, that's what I was going to tell you.
What is it?
The police are on a new trail. They think maybe a locksmith. Vicky, you listening? Maybe the creepers. A locksmith. Get him out, quick.
What nice lipstick you use, Mrs. Grant. It's a lovely shade.
Vicky, answer me, Vicky. Are you all right? Vicky! Vicky! Vicky!
Hurry. Catch me before I kill more. For heaven's sake.
Hello, City Desk. Yeah, Pearlie Chase. Yeah, shut up and listen. On that creeper story I just gave you, add this thought. The reward for his capture goes to the elevator boy. He heard Vicky Grant scream and called a cop. The creeper was shot running from the building. Yeah, ironical, wasn't it? The locksmith was the killer. The one man Vicky thought would protect her. What an ending to a lovely, lovely redhead.
Ah! I like pickles. But they don't like me.
And you saw the sun down,
Glad it doesn't like me.
Digel's special combination of antacid and anti-gas ingredients gives you fast, gentle relief from acid indigestion, heartburn, and gas in just minutes.
I like hot dogs, but they don't like me.
For occasional use only as directed.
In 1939, in hopes of launching a new radio series, Arch Obler took some of his own money and recorded an audition of The Ugliest Man in the World, his own work, his own play. He took that recording to NBC, who was looking to launch experimental radio series to rival the then popular and highly critically acclaimed CBS's Columbia Workshop. Obler got the series. It ran without a sponsor for the first year, and he had total creative control. It was ABC that named the series The Arch Obler Plays. Its time slot was less cool. You see, the series occupied the 7 to 7:30 period time slot against Jack Benny. Still, Arch Obler's plays would air in one form or another over a period of almost 33 years. That was the original Arch Obler Plays, which had 53 episodes. And then in 1945, Mutual Broadcasting would present an additional 26 plays under the moniker Arch Obler Plays. And then there was a 1964 revival. And finally, a 1971 revival. Altogether, during the 33 years, there would not be presented an extremely large number of new plays, 95 original stories. Arch Obler is underestimated as to his influence in old-time radio. It was enormous. He was a giant in the field, although not in life. He was actually kind of short and well-known for his eccentricities. Tonight from Arch Obler's Plays, we present the very last show of the series. From December the 26th of 1964, it's Him or Me.
Him or me, him or me, him or me, him or me, him or me. Why do I keep thinking that round in my head? Him or me, him or me. No! It's him, it's him, it's him. It's gotta be him. How can a lousy little rat... I gotta think. Figure out an angle. You got an angle, you can beat any rat. I'll figure out where it started, where it went, how it's been going. Then I'll figure out an angle. Now, where did it begin? Where did it begin? Wind. Why do I remember the wind? I stood in that lousy army transport deck and I was laughing. $15,000 in my kick and Chicago waiting. Nice and juicy. Yeah, I remember. First night back, that old sucker's car. Got off at the boat, night. He pulled up. He said,
"Want a lift, soldier?"
Yeah. Brand new convertible, I remember.
Are you sure you're warm enough, young man?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Cora, she's Mrs. Potter, always makes fun of me, carrying all those blankets and things. But when you've traveled on the road as long as I have and in my territory, you just have to be ready for any contingency.
You got a nice car.
Oh, yes. You see, it's a surprise for Mrs. Potter. But she won't know about it for 2 weeks.
Hey, mister, listen, could you pull up a minute? I feel so good.
What?
Paul, I'm going to be sick.
Oh, sure, sure. There you are. Do you want to get out? I mean, I...
Your hands! What? No! Please!
Yeah. Brand new convertible. 2 weeks, he said, and as old as he wouldn't start yelling to the cops for 3, and by that time I'd be back in Chicago on a car to have a new paint job and a new engine number. I looked out of the window. We were parked right on a bridge. And below, there was water.
Up you go.
You wanted to go fishing, mister?
Okay.
figure it all out. The time is gone. I gotta figure an angle. What happened then? I gotta remember. There's a car. Yeah. On the way to Chicago. Oh, but first I had to settle an old score I've been waiting for 15 years in my hometown.
Paper, mister? Paper?
No, no, no. Say, tell me something, will you? A guy named J.B. Roonan still run this town?
Old man Roonan?
Yeah.
Well, mister, he don't have to run it. He owns it. The bank, most of the filling stations, the newspaper. Well, old man Roonan's got... Hey, look.
Well,
see that dish crossing the street? That's old man Roonan's, too. That's his daughter.
That was you, Kay, he was talking about. And seeing you made it a lot easier to hang around town and figure out an angle to settle my score with your old man.
Have another, young man. Have another. After all, this is quite an occasion.
An occasion, Mr. Roonan?
Why, of course. Prodigal son returns with a fatted calf.
Oh, yeah? You run me out of town, didn't you, Mr. Roonan?
No, I didn't do that exactly. I felt another atmosphere would get you away from certain unfortunate influences. And it certainly did straighten you out. To think that you're now a businessman, no less. Yeah, the past is the past, as far as I'm concerned. And here you are, older, prosperous, and a welcome guest. Oh, Kathy, come in here. I want you to meet an old friend of mine.
Yeah, you were the answer, Kay, the angle. But you didn't want to play, did you, Kay?
Oh, Bill, please. I like you very much, of course I do. But after all, I've only known you a week. Oh, please, Bill, don't let me talk. I'm just a small-town girl. You frighten me a little. But I do like you very much. I think about you all the time.
Yeah, just a nice small-town girl, Kay. So, if wedding bells was the price of the payoff, okay, I said. I'd had the preacher say the words over me a couple of times before the war. One more time wasn't going to hurt me. And when I got through with you and your old man's bankroll, that'd square the score, yeah, with interest for 15 years.
I'm not for this marriage, Bill. Had I known you intended to stay in our town, I would have seen to it that my daughter never met you.
Papa didn't have a chance.
Bill, please, turn off the big light. Shining right in my eyes.
Oh, sure. Yeah, better.
Uh-huh.
Should I turn off the bed lamp, too?
After the champagne.
Oh.
I bet we're the only people who ever stole champagne from their own wedding. To us, Bill. Always.
Yeah.
Bill.
Mm.
Well, here I am, married to you, and I love you. But I don't really know you.
Hmm?
I've got to ask you something right now.
Well, go ahead.
All those years away from town, and then coming back all of a sudden, I've got to know, Bill. Did you come back because you didn't know she'd gotten married?
Nah.
I mean, Lily Ellis.
Oh.
Some people were saying you really left town because of her. Did you come back because of her, too?
Lily Ellis. She said Lily Ellis for a minute I couldn't remember. Lily Ellis, who? That I married her, too? And then I remember Jan, Von Gall I played around with. I said to Kay, no, baby, I don't even remember Lily Ellis. Now, how about another? And then I remember I started to get out of bed. My right foot touched the floor. Only it wasn't the floor. Something soft and warm. It bit. I fell over. I fell back in the bed. My elbow hit something. It was Kay. Screaming, running, the jaw to one side. And there was blood on my foot, and I knew. A rat. I stepped on a rat, and he bit me. And when I fell back, I hit Kay's jaw, and I'd broken it.
Rats! Rats! What do you mean, rats? It's a brand new house. How could there be any rats? Drunk! And you hit her and you broke her jaw. Well, you won't get the chance to hurt her again. She's safe at home and she's staying there. I'll get them married and old.
You went away, Mr. Roonan, when the door closed behind you. I knew that job was finished. It was no good. The weeks were wasted. I was out, cold. All my scheming, the dough, the gal, the payoff, all of it finished by one lousy little rat. Only me, was there a rat? I sat down, me and a bottle, and the more I kept drinking, the more I kept thinking. Was there a rat? Was there a rat? I fell asleep.
I woke up.
A shot? Who? And then I saw a bottle of whiskey smashed on the floor. In my sleep, I'd... And then I saw something else. Animal tracks, wet animal tracks, running across the floor as if something went through the liquor. I got to my feet and I followed them across the room, through the door, and then they were gone. They were lost in the carpet, but now I knew there was a rat.
I'll get you, you blind rat. I'll get you with the
rat. Yeah, I stood there yelling. Nobody had ever got the best of me. Nobody. O'Bannon, Sam Contreras, Max Reaver, dead, rotting. Nobody beat me. Nobody. I wasn't going away. I was staying there. As long as it took me to get that rat. Him or me. That's when I knew it. Him or me.
Now to return to Arch Obler's strange play, Him or Me. Listen to the thoughts of Bill Carr.
Him or me. No. Him. Yeah. Keep thinking of that. I want to do that morning. Yeah, I remember. I went out into the street, just like I was. Everybody saw me.
Hi, Mr. Carr. How's the bride?
Hi, Bill. What's the rush?
Hello, Bill. Anything I can do for you?
Yeah, some traps. Give me some traps, will you?
Traps? What kind of traps? Bear traps? Gopher?
Rat traps. Give me three. Make it four. Now, give me a dozen.
What?
And give me some poison. A dozen boxes of rat poison.
Now, wait a minute. There aren't that many rats in
town. Don't argue with you, you fool. Now, just stop. Get it for me, will you? Get it for me?
In a couple of minutes, I was out of the place, the stuff in my arms, almost running. I could see people turning me, watching me running, the stuff in my arms, my face the way it was, without washing, shaving. And then she was there, the blonde dame.
Bill Carr, of all people. Say, I bet you don't even remember
me.
Well, I was... You don't? You so-and-so. I'm Lily Allen.
Oh, sure. I knew. I mean, I...
Oh, you big, handsome lug. Haven't you got a kiss to your old girlfriend after all these years? Come on, I know you. You're not the bashful type.
And then you were grinding your lips on mine. Weren't you, Lily? You didn't think. You didn't know. You didn't care. Everybody watching. Everybody stopping in the street watching. Bill Carr, who just got married to old man Ruin's kid, kissing his old girlfriend out there in front of everybody.
Look, Bill, we're stopping traffic. Come on, let's get out of here. How about taking me to breakfast?
No, I...
All right. We'll go over to my place and... Well, for heaven's sake, what's in those boxes? Breakfast food? Poison grain. Well, for heaven's sake, Bill, what are you doing with all those boxes of poison grain? Who are you killing and when?
I got away from her. Back in the house, I set the traps. I put the poison stuff across the head of the stairs, crisscross all over the kitchen floor, and then I went into the bedroom. And then I saw. Where I left the bureau drawer open, everything was torn to pieces. All my identification papers, my billfold, and the rest of my dough. My dough. $15,000 chewed up in little pieces. My dough. And then a phone.
All right. Hello, who is it?
Hello. Is it you, Bill?
Yeah.
Well, this is Mr. Ronan. Kay's got in her head that she wants to come back there with you. Heaven knows why. But you better come over here and get her right away.
No, let her stay there.
What? What'd you say?
I said, let her stay there. I'm busy. Things are going on.
Listen to me, Bill Carr. Kathy's got hysterics. And if she wants to be with you, I blast it all. You better come over here and get her. You hear me right away?
Right away. Sure, why not? So I took a deep breath and I went over and got you, Kay. Sure. Because now the $15,000 was gone. But having you, we're going to have another chance to get your old man right in his cash box. He came with us. And when the two of you were all set in the house, I went down the street thinking of that $15,000 gone. And the back of my head was hurting like it was ready to bust wide open. Him or me, I had to do something. Traps, the poison grain, that wasn't enough. I had to be sure I'd get him fast before I blew my top. Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember. Lowdown was a big Tom. Like old man Frank always has around his cash feeding grain store. I went into the place.
Yes? Yes, what is it?
Hey, Mr. Frank, you got rats around here, huh?
Have I?
Well, how do you get rid of them?
Why?
We got rats at my house. Will you tell me a sure way to get rid of them?
Why?
Because I'll pay off, that's why. Any price. I'll pay you anything you want.
Well, I haven't got the stuff ready made, but would you want the formula?
The formula? Yeah, sure.
I got it written down on a paper here somewhere. Yeah, here it is. Cost you $2. Cash money.
Went down the street and I was feeling good. Old man Frank always knew what he was talking about. Holding that piece of paper tight in my hand, I went into Mr. Miller's drugstore.
Yes, what is it? Oh, how's the bridegroom? Shouldn't I?
Hey, this prescription. Can you fill this right away?
Prescription's my business. Hey, what's this for?
Old man Frank, give it to me. It's for killing rats.
Very dangerous.
Oh, sure. Come on, will you fill it? I'm in a hurry.
Oh, this is very dangerous. Very, very.
Half an hour later, he came back with two bottles. Mix them, he says. Be careful, he says. When I got home, Kay was sleeping. Her pa was snoring in the chair next to bed. So I went to the kitchen, I got a big glass dish, and I began to mix the stuff. All of a sudden...
Hey, what's going on here? What are you doing? What's that stuff you're mixing? Medicine?
No, don't touch it.
What's the matter with you? That poison is...
Yeah.
Poison?
Yeah. Sure, it's poison. Look, that rat, the one that bit me, just to kill him. Once and for all.
Oh. All right, Bill. All right, I've got to go home now to supper, but I'll be back later. Now, you've got to be careful.
He went, and as soon as he did, I finished mixing the stuff, and I filled half a dozen saucers with it. And then I put those saucers all the places I knew he'd go. Kitchen, living room, hallway. And then as I started down into the basement, in the other room, I grabbed the club I had already, the living room, the lights. Gotcha! Yeah, got him. Broken pieces of saucer on the floor and over him by the window. Him. Yeah. He was there just the way I dreamed about it. Looking up at me. Yeah. What'd he look like? He was big. Yeah. He was big. He was big as a tomcat. And he wasn't young. His fur was a gray that was an old gray. His head was sharp and pointed like a key to hell. With black, bright, beady eyes that knew all the answers in hell. Yeah. Yeah, his eyes. Something crazy. Just in that minute, he looked at me. He was that rat in that road near Frisco. Me in the car, him sitting by the man I'd killed, looking up at me. And all of a sudden, he moved. The club in my hand went up. Then I began to laugh. Because whatever he was, wherever he came from, I saw he couldn't get away from me. Not anymore. His hind legs. That poison had done something to him. Now he was just crawling along. He was crawling like a big gray crab in a dirty fur coat. I took a step forward. He stopped crawling. Looked at me like he was trying to figure a way out. There wasn't no way out. He took another little sidestep toward the window. Window was partway open. Another little sidestep, his eyes on me. Okay, I said to myself, okay. Three more steps, and then I'll give it to you. Took another step. But between that and the next step, he waited a long, long time. Looking at me all the time as if trying to figure out what I was thinking, what I was going to do. One more step, I said to myself. You got one step left. Claw started digging into the wood for another move, and then he changed his mind. But all of a sudden, I couldn't wait no more. Now, I swung the club. He wasn't there. Where he got the strength from, I don't know. He threw himself to one side of my club, missed him, and then he was gone. I stood there like I was struck dead. And then I heard... Hey, I'm coming. Yelling, waving the club, I ran to the bedroom. Kay, you were sitting up in the bed pointing your finger. I saw him on the floor moving toward you. I swung a club and the light went up. I swung blind in the dark, but I felt the club hit and crush. And then you, Kay, you were quiet. I didn't have a chance. No. The way I broke your jaw on a honeymoon, another girl coming back to town and kissing me, and me going around town to get the poison, and what the druggist said, what your pa said about the poison drink and the way I acted, what they dug up on me in Chicago. I didn't have a chance.
Him or me.
Clock. Why do I hear a clock? Time, yeah. I gotta have more time. An angle. I ain't figured out an angle. Nobody's ever licked me. Nobody. Now, how can a dirty, lousy little rat lick... Straps. They're putting straps on my feet. My hands. Mask over my head. They're gonna burn. Him or me? I guess it's me.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Peter Piazza. Am I Insane? By Guy de Maupassant. Am I insane or jealous? I know not which, but I suffer horribly. I committed a crime, it is true, but is not insane jealousy, betrayed love, and the terrible pain I endure enough to make anyone commit a crime without actually being a criminal? I have loved this woman to madness, and yet, is it true? Did I love her? No, she owned me. Body and soul, I was her plaything. She ruled me by her smile, her look, the divine form of her body. It was all those things that I loved. But the woman contained in that body, I despise her, I hate her. I always have hated her, for she is but an impure, perfidious creature in whom there was no soul. Even less than that, she is but a mass of soft flesh in which dwells infamy. The first few months of our union were deliciously strange. Her eyes were three different colors. No, I am not insane, I swear they were. They were gray at noon, shaded green at twilight, and blue at sunrise. In moments of love, they were blue. The pupils dilated and nervous, her lips trembled, and often the tip of her pink tongue could be seen as that of a reptile ready to hiss. When she raised her heavy lids, and I saw that ardent look, I shuddered not only for the unceasing desire to possess her, but for the desire to kill this beast. When she walked across the room, each step resounded in my heart. When she disrobed and emerged, infamous but radiant, from the white mass of linen and lace, a sudden weakness seized me. My limbs gave way beneath me, and my chest heaved. I was faint, coward that I was. Each morning when she awakened, I waited for that first look, my heart filled with rage, hatred, and disdain for this beast whose slave I was. But when she fixed those limpid blue eyes on me, that languishing look showing traces of lassitude, it was like a burning, unquenchable fire within me, inciting me to passion. When she opened her eyes that day, I saw a dull, indifferent look, a look devoid of desire, and I knew then she was tired of me. I saw it, knew it, felt it right away, that it was all over, and each hour and minute proved to me that I was right. When I beckoned her with my arms and lips, she shrank from me. "Leave me alone," she said. "You are horrid." Then I became suspicious, insanely jealous, but I am not insane. No, indeed. I watched her slyly. Not that she had betrayed me, but she was so cold that I knew another would soon take my place. At times she would say, "Men disgust me." Alas, it was too true. Then I became jealous of her indifference of her thoughts, which I knew to be impure. And when she awakened with that same look of lassitude, I suffocated with anger and an irresistible desire to choke her and make her confess the shameful secrets of her heart took hold of me. Am I insane? No. One night I saw that she was happy. I felt, in fact, I was convinced that a new passion ruled her. As of old, her eyes shone. She was feverish, and her whole self fluttered with love. I feigned ignorance, but I watched her closely. I discovered nothing, however. I waited a week, a month, almost a year. She was radiantly, ideally happy, as if soothed by some ephemeral caress. At last I guessed. No, I am not insane. I swear I am not. How can I explain this inconceivable, horrible thing? How can I make myself understood? This is how I guessed. She came in one night from a long ride on horseback and sank exhausted in a seat facing me. An unnatural flush tinted her cheeks and her eyes, those eyes that I knew so well, had such a look in them. I was not mistaken. I had seen her look like that. She loved. But whom? What? I almost lost my head, and so as not to look at her, I turned to the window. A valet was leading her horse to the stable, and she stood and watched him disappear. Then she fell asleep almost immediately. I thought and thought all night. My mind wandered through mysteries too deep to conceive. Who can fathom the perversity and strange caprices of a sensual woman? Every morning she rode madly through hills and dales, and each time she came back languid, exhausted. At last I understood. It was of the horse I was jealous, of the wind which caressed her, of the drooping leaves, of the dewdrops, of the saddle which carried her. It was all of these things which made her so happy and brought her back to me, satiated, exhausted. I resolved to be revenged. I became very attentive. Every time she came back from a ride, I helped her down, and the horse made a vicious rush at me. She would pat him on the neck, kiss his quivering nostrils without even wiping her lips. I watched my chance. One morning, I got up before dawn and went to the path in the woods she loved so well. I carried a rope with me, and my pistols were hidden in my breast, as if I were going to fight a duel. I drew the rope across the path, tying it to a tree on each side, and hid myself in the grass. Presently, I heard her horse's hooves. Then I saw her coming at a furious pace, her cheeks flushed, an insane look in her eyes. She seemed enraptured, transported into another sphere. As the animal approached the rope, he struck it with his forefeet and fell. Before she had struck the ground, I caught her in my arms and helped her to her feet. I then approached the horse, put my pistol close to his ear, and shot him, as I would a man. She turned on me and dealt me two terrific blows across the face with her riding whip, which felled me. And as she rushed at me again, I shot her. Tell me, am I insane? End of Am I Insane? Recording by Peter Piazza.
Oh, I'm sorry to do this to you, but we'll get right back to our programming in a moment. Okay, we're going to climb into the time machine for real. We're going to run an episode of The Witch's Tale, which is credited with being the first horror-themed radio show in history. The show began in 1931 with writer-director Alonzo Dean Cole somehow convincing New York station WOR to try a series devoted entirely to the supernatural. Nobody would have predicted that the radio series would become the premier radio program of its time and would run until 1938. Still, fondly remembered by fans today. There were only about 36 episodes left. Apparently, when Cole moved from New York to California, he destroyed the recordings of most of his shows. And the 36 or so surviving recordings exist due to the efforts of others. Yet, it was just that by 1961, Cole had come to believe that there was no commercial value to the actual recording transcription. He did keep bound copies of his 332 scripts, which are protected by copyright. So, settle back and listen to old Nancy tell you about the Haunted Crossroads, which originally aired on October the 17th of 1932.
The Witch's Tale. The fascinations of the eerie. Weird, blood-chilling tales told by old Nancy, the witch of Salem, and Satan, her wise black cat. They're waiting, waiting for you, now.
I be today? Yes, sir, 122-year-old. Well, Satan, tell everyone to douse their light. That's it. We want lots of darkness when we tell their bedtime stories. Now, draw up to the fire and gaze into the embers. Gaze into them deep, and soon by the light of the moon and the stars, you'll see a barren stretch of land where two roads meet in old Massachusetts State. Three policemen stand a-talking there beside their motorcycle bikes, and soon you'll hear the story of the Haunted Crossroads. The Haunted Crossroads!
Sure you're not scared to have us leave you here alone, Tom?
Of course he's scared, Sergeant. Look at his knee shaking. I'll probably yell for help the minute you guys get out of his sight.
Sure, Jim. I don't think he is properly frightened.
I guess not. Well, if he sees any spooks, he can't say we haven't warned him.
Seriously, boy, you'll keep your eyes peeled for other things than ghosts on this patrol.
You bet I will, Uncle Pat. And I hope it's my luck to have the skunk who knocked up Smith and Barclay here start something with me.
Well, I hardly think that'll happen. Those killings weren't done by the same man.
They were both stabbed in the back the same way.
Oh, well, that doesn't prove anything. Several fellows were stabbed to death here right after the Civil War. And another about 20 years ago, according to all records. It wasn't the same murderer who got them and two cops of our troops. Well, unless you believe the crazy stories about this place being haunted.
Well, I must be riding back to troop headquarters for Captain Elton, risking in the height of it. And you, Gene Harvey, you better be after getting on your patrol.
Well, I'll get the old bike moving.
Oh,
When you get home in the morning, Tom, remind your sister she's got a movie date with me tomorrow night.
Kathleen's not apt to forget any date she has with you.
True, but Hattie, your job at the moment is to keep your eye peeled for speeders and reckless drivers.
Well, I'll try to remember that, Sarge.
And good night.
Good night, Jean.
Bye, bye.
Kathleen, the morning
kid, coming back.
Dean.
I'm coming, Sarge.
Tom, all merciful God.
Sarge, what is it? What has happened?
Please.
I'm here. What happened? Tom.
Yes. He's dead. Still.
He can't be dead. We just left him.
I started right after you rode away. Then I heard him yelling, oh, merciful God, I raised that boy. He was like my own.
He's been stabbed in the back. Just as Smith was stabbed a week ago in Barclay.
Here at these same rotten crossroads.
Now pull yourself together, Sarge. You know what I thought of Tom. But we're cops. Listen, you were back here before I did. You must have seen...
I saw no more than you see now. Whoever did it got away.
Take it easy. Tom wasn't alone here more than a minute. No one could have gotten to him across these open fields and then away again between the time I left and come back. Yet I saw no one but him and you. What was that?
A woman's laugh. A woman's laugh. You hear it too?
It sounded here, beside me.
Right here beside us, at me by the elbow.
Yet no one's here. But we can see.
Invisible woman. That's the craziest part of your whole crazy story.
But we did hear it, Captain Elton.
It's true, so help me.
But there wasn't any woman, by your own confession. You said you searched and couldn't find her.
We looked everywhere around, sir. But there's no place there for anyone to hide.
And like the hicks around here, you come to the conclusion those old crossroads are haunted.
A female ghost stabbed Tom Fallon with a very ungodly steel knife, I suppose. Which she carried away with her because you couldn't find it either. That's a fine way for two policemen to explain a murder.
We're only telling you what really happened.
But it couldn't have happened.
Just the same it did. Now look here, sir. Tom Fallon was my closest friend. I'm engaged to marry his sister. And Sergeant McGee here is his uncle. You don't think we'd lie to you when Tom's dead body lies out there in the squad room?
He was like me own son.
Oh, here, Sergeant Pat. Sit down. I'm sorry I have to pound at you like this. But Tom is the second of the two that has been killed inside a week. At the same place, in the same way. And last year, we found Barclay dead there. Three policemen stabbed to death, and we haven't a single lead to the rat who did it.
You think the same person killed them all, sir?
Yes, and that person's a man, not a laughing, invisible woman. A man with strength enough to kill with a single blow.
Hardy, you say Fallon wasn't out of your sight for more than a few minutes before you heard him scream.
Well, I'd only passed the first turn south of the crossroads, sir. A minute and a half at most.
And you got back to him in about half that time. How about you, Sergeant McGee?
I left him right after Trooper Halley rode away, sir, and headed north.
And neither of you saw any vehicles approaching from the east or west, nor past any?
No, sir. There was no traffic at all.
Then, in the 70 or 80 seconds that Fallon was alone, someone ran across that completely open space, drove a knife into Tom Fallon's back, and then ran away again.
Oh, it's crazy, but that's the way it must have happened.
It's the only way it could have happened.
It didn't happen! It's impossible! The world's greatest sprinter couldn't have covered the necessary distance in that short time. And the running man must make a little noise. Yet Fallon saw and heard nothing until a knife was in his back. You're lying to me, both of you.
By the Lord, if I didn't know how close you were to the boy, I'd say you bumped him off yourself.
Captain Elton!
Don't say that, don't.
Boy, I'm sorry. I don't mean that, of course. But unless you fellas change your story, the coroner's jury is going to ask some mighty embarrassing questions. You've established yourselves as the only persons in the vicinity who could have come close enough to Fallon.
No one's going to think we had anything to do with this when they recollect those other killings at the crossroads. Even if they won't believe we heard that woman laugh. You've forgotten, Captain, that Tom is the third to die out there. By the same man's hand, you say. Last week when Smith was killed, Sergeant McGee and I were on duty with you in this station from the time Smith left here until his body was found. And when Barclay got here a year ago,
then George, you and I were up in Maine, Torres, doing some fishing. Don't you remember? And Jean here.
And I was serving a motorcycle escort for the governor. Now, no one will question that alibi.
Yeah, you're right. But if you've told me the truth about tonight, what's the answer?
I didn't have to listen to such a nutty yarn about Smith's and Barclay's murders, for no one was near them when it happened. They'd been dead for hours when found.
Oh, excuse me, boys, the things I've said. If I don't find someone to pin these stabbings on pretty soon, I'll be believing those damn crossroads are haunted. That's all. Just a minute. Tom?
There's Fallon that's here, sir.
Bring her in.
Yes, sir.
Does she know her brother is...
No. I telephoned her to come down here. That's all.
You'd better break the news, Pat.
You're her uncle.
No. No, not me. I can't even see her now. Let me out this other door before she...
Pat, here she is.
Captain Dalton, why did you telephone me to come down here? Uncle Pat, why are you here? What's wrong?
Let me out of here. Let me out.
Uncle Pat, it's Tom. Something's happened to Tom.
Don't look at me. I don't know anything about it.
Kathleen, dear.
Miss Fallon.
Tom was posted at the crossroads tonight. He's been killed there, like the others.
Yes. Your brother is...
Oh, Tom.
Dearest Kathleen.
Let me out of here, or let me out.
Oh, Pat.
I can't bear to hear her cry like that. I can't bear to have her eyes upon me. She has eyes like Tom, and they accuse me. They accuse me.
Accused?
Before God, I swear I didn't mean to kill him.
Did you?
Yes, I killed him. I didn't tell you the truth. I never left him at his post at all. I killed the boy I loved because something from the blackest hell got into me. I stabbed a knife into his back because I couldn't help myself. I was mad to do it, mad to do it. No, I'll pay for what I've done.
Don't let him get his gun.
He shot himself.
Uncle Pat.
He's dead. Tom Fallon's murderer has just killed himself.
He stabbed my brother. Oh, no, no, he couldn't.
You heard what he said, Miss Fallon.
But who killed Smith and Barclay?
McGee couldn't have done that.
No.
Why did he say he couldn't help himself? That he was made to kill his nephew.
And what was the meaning of that woman's laugh I heard?
You can put away your gun. But I'm glad to know you're being so careful here.
Why drive away out here at this hour, honey?
Oh, I couldn't sleep knowing you were posted alone at these crossroads tonight.
Dear, I told you not to worry. A trooper's been posted alone here every night for 3 weeks now. Ever since poor Tom was killed. And nothing's happened.
You think there's no danger here anymore, now that Uncle Pat's dead?
Look, you mustn't stop thinking about him now.
Well, it's rather difficult not to think about him. I'll never understand
why... He was out of his mind. That's the only explanation.
But what drove him out of his mind? What could have made him destroy someone he loved, as we know he loved Tom? And he said he was made to do it.
I don't know.
Dean, you're all I have left. If anything should happen to you now...
Now, nothing's going to hurt me, dear. Come on, get a hold of yourself, sweetheart.
But Uncle Pat had nothing to do with the other deaths here. He was miles away when Smith and Barclay were stabbed. Dean, maybe this place is haunted.
Oh, you don't believe that stuff any more than I do. You're just all upset and... here... I'm going to disobey all standing orders of the state police and join you in this car for a little roadside parking.
Oh, no, don't get in. I'd rather get out and walk a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been out here before, you know. At night, I mean.
Yeah, and you shouldn't be here now. Fine thing, driving this deserted old road at midnight. Have you got that little gun I gave you?
Oh, yes, I always carry it when I drive alone.
Ah, that's good. Well, come on, then, if you want to walk.
Gee, exactly where did you find Tom's body? Uncle Pat healing beside him.
We're not going to talk any more about that.
Oh, all right. It really wouldn't do me any good to know. It's such a gloomy spot here. No car passing, no road lamps.
These are just old county roads. No state trooper had to patrol here regularly until...
Until after Frank Barclay was found stabbed here.
Oh, Kathleen.
I want to talk about it, Jean. I loved Uncle Pat. He was a good man, not a killer or a maniac. And I've got to find out what made him do the thing he did. Find out what made him say he couldn't help himself. Uncle Pat was in Maine when Frank Barclay was killed. Tell me about that.
Well, all I know is that Barclay didn't report on schedule. When they found him, he'd been dead for several hours.
And then Smith, just a week before Tom.
Like Barclay, he'd been dead for a long time when found.
But Uncle Pat couldn't have done it.
Oh, he wasn't out of my sight, and that of a dozen others at any time that night. Well, after that, Captain Elton made this a fixed post.
Oh, I can't understand it.
Neither can anyone else.
And 70 years ago, the papers say, a Tom Constable was stabbed here, and another constable about the time we were children. That makes five. All policemen.
Screwy, all right. But you mustn't think about it anymore, dear. And look, don't worry about me. Look around here. There's nothing but open spaces, sand and grass, and two level hard dirt roads. Why, there isn't a bush or stone big enough for a cat to hide behind, let alone a man with a knife.
No one could come close to you here, except someone you knew and trusted. As Uncle Pat is trusted by Tom, as you trust me.
That's enough nonsense now. Go home, go to bed, and sleep. And keep that little automatic of yours handy on the way. Night driving's no business for a woman.
I wish you'd let me stay.
Not a chance. You want me to lose my job? That's what happens to cops who entertain ladies during business hours.
But it's so gloomy here. So silent and eerie. It looks like a haunted place.
Oh, bunk. Here, give me a kiss and say goodnight.
Oh, Jean, I can't lose you.
You're not going to. I'm safer here than I'd be in a church. What was that?
A woman laughing.
That's what I heard the other night.
Look there.
A woman's in the road.
She wasn't there a moment ago.
I'll soon find out.
Jean, come back here.
Look, stay in the car, Kathleen. You in the black dress. I want to talk to you.
No, don't follow her, Jean. Come back.
Wait, I tell you, whoever you are. Don't walk away from me. I'm an officer.
Don't go away. Don't do it. Stop. Oh, there it got to, Jean. Give away. She disappeared. She vanished as I watched her. Where did she go to? Come back here, Jean. Come back. Come back.
Coming.
What happened to that woman?
Coming.
Jean, what's happened to you?
I've got to do it.
Why do you stare at me like that?
Got to do it. Got to do it.
Why are you opening that pocket knife?
I can't help myself. Can't help myself.
You look as though you didn't know me. As though I'm someone you hate. Jean, I'm Kathleen. You love me.
Kathleen. Love.
Don't come any closer.
Kathleen. Love. You're dumb, Kathleen. Shoot me before I reach you. Shoot me. It's the only way to stop me, but I can't help myself.
No, no.
Just shoot me or I'll kill you with this knife.
Oh, you're mad.
Shoot, I say, before I drive this knife into your back.
Oh, my God, forgive me. It's the only way. I've got to, Keith. I've got to.
Miss Fallon, I want to hear more about this woman who laughed, this ghost.
Oh, please don't ask me any more questions now. I'll go up to that operating room again, Captain Elton. Make sure that Dean's going to live. I only shot him to stop him.
You stopped him, all right.
Oh, here's the doctor at last. Oh, doctor.
It's all right, Miss Fallon. We've taken the bullet out of Cooper Hardy's shoulder, and he'll be up and around again in just a few days.
Oh, thank God. Thank God.
And also Dean's tough constitution. Now, that's off your mind. Will you please tell me exactly what happened at the crossroads tonight?
I'll answer all your questions now.
What I've already heard has made me very curious. Sit down, Doc. It's your office and your hospital. Go ahead, Miss Fallon. Let's hear all about that laughing, appearing and disappearing woman.
If I were you, Captain, I'd withhold my judgment a while. The Cooper Hardy has been babbling about the phantom woman under the ether. Under the ether, people don't lie. He's been repeating over and over that he couldn't help himself.
He couldn't. Some way, somehow, she made him want to kill me. But he loved me. That love was stronger than her power. He had time to warn me.
So you obligingly shot him?
Yes.
Then the woman reappeared again?
Yes, beside me. And she laughed. She laughed horribly. And then, as I looked at her, she just wasn't there.
A woman dressed in black, you say?
Yes. A dress all folds that might have been a shroud. And her face was like the dead. But with an awful purpley tinge, as if she'd been strangled. Around the throat, there was a heavy rope that dangled to the ground. Oh, good, I'll see it on the day I die.
I don't believe in ghosts. You just shot one of my troopers. I don't care if you were engaged to marry him.
That's enough, Captain.
Out what?
I'm locked inside the walls of this hospital. And this girl is in no physical condition to stand your third degree. Besides, I think she's telling the truth.
The truth?
Why not? We can't call a thing a lie simply because we don't understand it. And have you any better explanation than we've heard for the tragedy at those old crossroads?
You don't think anything supernatural?
I think something that has lived beyond the span of ordinary human life is responsible. Remember those almost forgotten cases the newspapers have searched out? The man who was stabbed there in 1865? That other chap in the early 1900s? One of the reporters told me they'd discovered several more crossroads stabbings in the records. A peace officer was killed there in Andy Jackson's time. And a member of the watch was stabbed when Washington was president.
All policemen.
By Jove. I hadn't thought of it just in that light. Miss Fallon, you say the phantom woman had a rope round her neck?
Yes, a thick rope tied with a heavy knot.
A hangman's rope. And at the crossroads in the early days, criminals were hanged and buried.
What's that got to do with it?
Maybe a lot more than you think. Excuse me, Captain. Leave a chair aside so that I can get to that bookcase.
What?
I want to find something. Something I've read and more than half forgotten. Policemen, officers of the law. They've been the only ones to die at those crossroads where a gallows tree once stood.
Oh, that's a coincidence.
But you must admit a strange coincidence. Here's the book. An old history of this county.
History?
Here it is. I knew I read it somewhere. Look.
What is it, Doctor?
I'll read it to you. Listen. On that 13th day of August, 1721, by order of the King's Governor, a gibbet of good stout oak had been erected at Berkeley Crossroads. That's the old name of our place, Captain Elton.
Go on, reading.
And there the criminal, Goody Fairfax, was taken, still protesting her innocence of the foul crimes that the jury put here.
Hold more tightly on her, Peter, so I can fix this rope round his scrawny neck.
Let me go! Let me go! You cannot kill me!
She wriggles like an ear.
No, wait no more, Tom.
Fall to the bay.
No, I have done no murder. Have mercy. I am innocent, I swear.
Hey, you've had a fair trial. James has been found guilty.
And soon be a crime, you'll be buried in the soil of infamy. Here beneath this gallows tree.
Hey! Oh, you pass me. Sit upon your grave.
I not suffer that, I won't.
The rope's fast at last.
All is ready, my lord sheriff. When you give the word.
Wild!
Our law of the king's high sheriff speaks.
Nay, I who am about to die this unjust death will speak. Hear me, ye officers of so-called justice, who have decreed this fate for me. As I die innocent of crime, I vow to return from death the murderer you to hang me for. As ye officers of blind lord who visit death on me, so I shall visit death on you, with no more sense of right or pity. You mean to bury me beneath this gibbet, in unhallowed ground, away from God. Whilst I remain away from God, beware. Beware, I warn ye, for not even death will stay my hate. I shall return to bring ye death, ye officers of law.
Bring her up! Pull on the rope!
Aye! And so, still screaming her threats of ghostly vengeance, the murderess, Goody Fairfax, was hanged to death. Then the old account goes on. Her body was cut down from the gallows and buried underneath it at Berkeley Crossroads.
The haunted crossroads.
Captain Elton, whether or not you believe in ghosts, it might be a kindly thing if you search for Goody Fairfax's grave. And if you find it,
to place her restless bones in hallowed ground. A kindly thing and a wise thing.
I haven't got over it yet. There were human bones, a woman's bones, buried beneath those crossroads.
I knew you'd find them if you only persisted in the search.
Yeah, he persisted, all right. Making us troopers do the digging. With me, I'm double shift. Ah, fine way to treat a man only a week out of hospital.
And a newly married man.
Oh, I thought that was a good way for you to earn your sergeant stripe.
Sergeant stripe?
Yeah, here's your warrant.
Captain Elton.
I had to make you two crazy ghost seers some kind of a wedding present. And this didn't cost me anything.
Oh, how could we ever thank you?
Be happy. And Kathleen, let that first shot you had at your husband be the last.
Well, that's the end of that, Satan. You folks come see us again on me birthday. We'll have another cheerful yarn to sing ye.
It is not remarkable that so many of the reported ghosts and phantoms and supernatural visions have been observed just as night was falling. For that is the time when the mind is fatigued and is most subject to hallucinations. And yet, there are some, like that which Captain Nolan saw in the plains of Normandy, which cannot be so easily explained away. It was during the latter days of the First World War that cavalry troops under the command of Captain David Nolan had rendered valuable service in a score of crucial battles. They had been under fire for weeks on end, and now they were retiring behind the lines for a rest they had fully earned. The long column of horsemen moved slowly, wearily through the twilight. At their head rode Captain Nolan and two other officers. They were discussing how they intended to spend their leave.
You men can celebrate all you like. The only thing I want to do is to sleep.
Each man to his own taste, Digby. Mine happened to run toward wine, women, and song.
That sounds much more attractive to me.
In the states I'm in, I couldn't even think of...
Good Lord! Captain Nolan broke off abruptly in the middle of the sentence. For it was just at that moment that he saw the phantom horsemen. They were clad in white, on white steeds, and they rode in a straight, silent column, paralleling the line of the captain's own men, not more than a dozen yards away. So swiftly did they move, and so soundlessly, that their horses' hooves seemed scarcely to be touching the ground. And the column did not end. It went on and on, one ghostly figure following another through the gathering dusk. Captain Nolan's first impulse was to turn to his fellow officers to call their attention to the amazing vision. But then he thought better of it, so he rode on in silence. For some reason, the men beside him had grown silent too. But a few moments later, while the captain's eyes were still fastened on the incredible cavalcade, Lieutenant Digby said suddenly,
"You may have something there after all, Captain. I could stand a good night's rest myself."
Nolan turned sharply and peered into Digby's face, as though he was seeking something there.
"What made you change your mind?"
"Oh, I don't know. I suppose I'm more tired than I thought."
"It seemed to hit you rather abruptly."
"Yes. Yes, it did, didn't it, Captain?"
And that was all the lieutenant would say. Once again, silence fell among the three men. But this time, it was short-lived. For after another moment or so, Lieutenant Wayne blurted out violently, almost hysterically,
"I can't stand this any longer. You see them? So does Digby. We're not dreaming. And we're not just tired either. That column of cavalrymen is really there. If it weren't, why should all three of us be watching it?"
Yes, each of the three officers had seen the column at the same moment. And each had remained silent for fear of making himself look ridiculous. Night descended swiftly now, and the phantom horsemen were blotted from view. But at the next town, Captain Nolan sent back a searching party. They returned with the inevitable answer. No other cavalry troops were in the vicinity. None could have been. And yet, afterward, Captain Nolan and Lieutenants Digby and Duane, all men of unquestionable integrity, were willing to swear that they had seen the same identical vision. A vision incredible but true.
Okay, one last break here and then we'll be right back. Another seminal radio program is from the creator of Lights Out, Quiet Please, which began on June the 8th of 1947 and would run for a couple of years on the Mutual Network until October the 13th of 1948 and then would move over until June the 20th of 1949 to NBC. Wilbur Cooper created it, wrote it, and directed it. But he found in Ernest Chappell a star and host that was very sympathetic to Cooper's own writing style. Cooper and Chappell probably worked so well together because they were friends, close friends, from before the series began. Chappell understood Cooper, and because of this sympathy, was able to bring about a depth of characterization that is uncommon these days, or any days. One of the problems that I have found is that there are very few really good recordings from Quiet Please. They're all a bit noisy, and that includes this one. This is why I put it at the end. If the quality is too poor, well, you've heard most of the show already, and you won't lose a whole lot if you just tune it out. But I recommend you don't. This is one of the better ones. It's called Adam and the Darkest Day, and it originally aired on November the 7th of 1948.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please. I used to go down and walk along the lakefront years and years ago, before the dark days. Just walk along the shore and smile at the lake, and it would smile back at me. And it didn't smell salty and fishy the way the ocean does. Oh, yes, I've seen the ocean, too. Both oceans, there are two of them. I forget their names. And even during the dark days when Doc said it was safe to go out, I'd go out of a morning and walk along where the lake shore used to be. It's all swamp now, and there are some pretty weird things in it. Things that used to be fish once, only they've gone through a lot of changes, and they're not fish anymore. Mutants, Doc said they were, things that have gone through mutations, changes. Yeah, I don't understand it, but it's interesting, Doc. Doc said they might even get to be human beings in another 15 or 20 million years, if they're left alone. Doc said that's the way human beings started originally. The only difference, Doc said, is that it took a couple of million years for the first changes to take place. And with these fish things, it took place practically overnight. Of course, it was a pretty long night. I guess I was about 20 when the war started. I say I guess because I don't really know when it did start. I guess nobody knows. One minute people were buying and selling things to each other, and talking and laughing and looking at the lake and the sunshine and stuff and just being people. And the next minute they were fighting and yelling and killing each other. And, I guess just being people in another way. Yeah, it was pretty rough. My Uncle Bryce was in the last war, the one before this one. He had some pretty terrible things to tell us about it. He always said, "Well, Adam, if another war comes, that's all. Because this one will start without any notice, and there won't be any such thing as battlefields and soldiers and all that. Everybody will be in it, no matter where they are, at home or wherever. And everybody will fight with each other till there isn't anybody left.
It'll be just like the Kilkenny cats, Uncle Brewster. And that's pretty nearly the way it was, wasn't it? Well, you know, there was an awful lot of people lived in this Chicago. I guess it was about 4 million. The houses and buildings they lived in were right up against each other. Well, about 4 million. Well, you know the stars? You look up at them some night and you see what an awful lot of them there are. Then you figure there was about as many people living in Chicago as there are stars. Well, there's lots more stars, but you can't see them without a telescope. Telescope, a thing. I got one somewhere. I'll show it to you. Well, that's right. There were 4 million people in this Chicago. And what's more, there was a lot more places around the country just as big, some of them bigger. No, I'm not making it up. I remember there was a place called New York, a place called Minneapolis, and a place called Los Angeles. Sure, they named all the places where people lived. Yeah, it seems a long time ago. Well, it is. I've kind of lost track of time, but it must be 30 years ago at least. And we've come a long way in 30 years. You know, in the next 10, 15 million years, who knows what'll happen. Well, after the war started, this place, this Chicago, was pretty well destroyed. The buildings got smashed, the people got killed, everything was just terrible. There was a lot of soldiers there, people that were paid to fight. But the soldiers couldn't get away. There wasn't anybody to fight with because you couldn't see them. You'd be standing there and there'd be a noise and fire and smoke. The whole big building would fall down right in front of you. People would scream and yell and run around and cry. I got mad at the soldiers, I remember. Pretty soon it wasn't safe for a soldier to be seen in the streets. And for that matter, it wasn't safe for anybody, but a soldier especially. Because people would do terrible things to them. Well, as I said, the buildings were all being knocked down. It was getting along toward winter. It was cold. People were having an awful time. So I looked around. There wasn't anything else to do. And I found me a place. It was a big warehouse. The place where people stored things. They'd buy furniture and stuff for their homes, and then they'd lock all the stuff up in the warehouse. Well, I don't know why. It wasn't important. So, this warehouse was a great big, strong, heavy building. It was on the corner of a street that had a number and another big wide street with a parkway down the middle, all green grass and flowers and trees. You know, it was awfully pretty there where the warehouse was. It had got knocked around a little, but it was still a fine, big, safe place. The people that owned it had got killed or went away or something. So I just moved in. Well, it was a mighty good thing for me that I did. Because the second night I was there, behind those nice, thick walls and those big doors, somebody did something that blew Chicago off the map. Off the map. Yeah, that's an old saying. It means that a place just disappears. And that's what happened to Chicago. All except a little bit of this warehouse I'm telling you about, a little part way down deep. On the ground where I was asleep, and where I found Doc, and I found Emily. I didn't know anybody else was there. My head hurt. It just seemed as if I couldn't hear anything or see anything, even feel anything, except my head hurting for the longest time. And finally, I was able to get up. It was black dark. I moved around a little. I got up. And I could walk there in the darkness. And then somebody took hold of my arm.
Who are you?
I'm Adam.
You're what?
Adam. What are you laughing at?
Boy, if I'm not badly mistaken, they gave you the right name.
Huh?
Well, that's just a little gag, son. You all right?
My head hurts. Who are you?
Well, my name is Fred Straley.
Well,
everybody calls me Doc. That is, when there was everybody. How do we get out of here?
Well, there was a door someplace.
I expected there would be.
What happened?
That I don't know, son, but whatever it was. Hey, wait a minute. Where are you?
Here.
Don't go opening any doors yet.
Why? I want to get out of here.
You got anything to eat?
Oh, there was some stuff in here someplace. Some cans and stuff.
Good.
How'd you get in here? I thought that...
I got lost.
You're not a soldier, are you?
Me? No, no, son, I'm not. I'm a scientist.
Oh?
That's a very vague term, though, isn't it? I'm a geneticist.
What's that?
Let's say that I kind of study. Well, you know what biology is?
No.
Well, it's the science of life, see? My racket's a special part of biology.
Oh.
What's the matter?
I thought maybe you were one of these fellows that makes bombs out of atoms or whatever it is.
No, no, I don't do that. I study the effect of nuclear fission and all that on human beings and whatnot.
Oh. Let's get out of here.
No, I don't think we will, Adam.
Why not? Oh, my
well, goodness. In the first place, Adam, I don't think it's very healthy outside. And in the second place, I seriously doubt we can get out of here.
Well, if we can't, we can make a noise, hammering or something, somebody will come and dig us out.
Well, yes, except for one thing, Adam.
What?
I don't think there's anybody out there.
Well, maybe not right now, but somebody will come.
I doubt it.
Why?
Because I'm pretty fairly sure there's nobody left in Chicago, Adam, except you and me. See what I mean?
And so there was somebody else. Emily. We stumbled around in the dark for quite a while before we found her. When we did find her, she was so scared she couldn't talk. She had a flashlight when she came in the place. She dropped it, couldn't find it again. Flashlight, it was a kind of a thing like a stick, only it was metal. You pressed a button and the light came on. Finally wore out. Well, finally Emily found her voice again. Once she got started, we couldn't stop her for the longest time.
Walking, for days. We went out in Lake Forest and we had a bad time out there. And people started dying from some disease nobody ever heard of. And I decided to run away. I took some money. I was afraid to take any food because maybe it was the food that was giving people the horrible diseases and making them die. All I wanted to do was get as far away from my friends as I could, and I walked and walked and walked. And then a soldier chased me, and a man hit him and knocked him down, and the man started after me, and I ran, and the door was open, and I ran, and something happened.
What did happen?
Could you stop crying now for sure?
I'll try.
Because, believe me, it won't do a particle of good, young lady from Lake Forest.
My name's Emily.
It won't do a particle of good, Emily.
Are we going to die?
Not at just this moment, Emily, but I have an idea we may not be very interested in living after we know a little more about what did happen.
Are you hungry, Emily?
I haven't had anything to eat for... I don't know how long.
Well, there's some cans and stuff.
Yes, I think they'll be safe to eat, Adam.
Safe?
If anything, safe. Can you find them all right?
I think so. I think they're over here, or maybe...
Light a match.
A match?
A little stick with something on the end of it, and you rubbed it on a wall or something, and there was a fire. We found it very useful. Well, I don't want to talk to you about that awful place. The awful, black, stuffy little place that saved our lives. Because we were down there for, well, I don't know how long it was. It must have been 2 months, 3 months. I don't know how long. It was water. It was more of the canned stuff. And I thought the part of the warehouse cellar we were in had been used for storing different kinds of food, so we didn't starve. But it was awful. It was awful. Finally, I said to Doc one day. I didn't know day from night, of course. I said to Doc, Doc, I'm going to get out of here. They're all going to go crazy if we don't get out of here.
I know that, son. It's been bothering me a little, too. Not that it makes any difference. We all three went crazy, of course.
I want to get out of here.
Why can't we get out of here?
Well, look, I told you I had a pretty good idea what happened, and I also have a pretty good idea that it wouldn't be very healthy outside for a long time. So that's why
I know you told us that, but How are we ever going to get out of this? Have we got to stay down here forever?
No.
What?
What do you mean, Doc?
I've been out.
You have?
Yeah.
Can we go?
I've been keeping it to myself.
Why?
Well, I didn't like it outside.
But you're all right, Doc.
Yes, I'm all right. I'm alive, if you want to call that all right.
Is there anything out there to hurt us, Doc?
Anything to hurt you? No, there isn't anything out there to hurt you. In fact, there isn't anything at all.
And when Emily and I followed Doc out through the tunnel he had found, and through the dark caves the tunnel led to, with water dripping and little things scrambling out from under our feet in the dark, when we crawled out into the daylight, we found out Doc was right. There wasn't anything. Yes, just like it is now, just nothing. Only then the nothingness was so new. There wasn't any Chicago at all, just a big flat prairie, everything all gray. A gray sky. I looked around to see if the lake was reflecting the gray sky. There wasn't any lake either. But a long way off, I could see the edges of the marsh and the swamp it had turned into. And I could smell the dead fishes. That was all there was to smell. They were the only dead things left. And we three were the only live ones.
So dark.
Is it? I mean, what time of day is it?
The lake was on the east, wasn't it?
Right.
Drexel Boulevard ran along this way. And this was 43rd Street, east and west.
And there isn't a sign of...
Oh, the sun's a little south of east. It's morning.
Morning.
About the time of day people be going to work.
Morning.
The sun seems so far away.
Doc, is it like this every place?
Well, that I don't know, Adam.
But it can't be.
It very well can be, Emily.
Are we the only ones left?
I don't know. And I don't think we'll ever find out.
I don't understand.
We might go away from here and maybe find somebody, but we don't know which way to go, and there's only one way to go. Walk.
But somebody will come and find us.
If there is anybody.
Well, there must be somebody.
If there is, child, they'll be just as dead as we'll be for very long.
Why?
Did you say something about the sun a little while ago?
Why,
I said it. I said the sun seemed so far away, didn't I?
Well, that's what you say.
Well, it is.
Is what?
Far away. And we're getting farther away from it every second.
I don't get that.
Let's go back, shall we? Cold out here.
This is what Doc told us down there in the cave where we'd found each other. This is what we listened to sitting there in the half dark, the feeble daylight filtering in through a hole we made in our roof. Think of us sitting there, Emily's hand in mine, Doc not looking at us as he talked. This is what Doc said. Listen.
We had this figured out quite a while ago, Ross Wilson and I. We were pretty sure what had happened one day when the right kind of bomb went off. We knew what the physical effects would be on cities, on the surface of the earth, and on people. And we guessed what might happen if a giant bomb were set off. A bomb big enough to know what this one did. We worked on it for years. Well, we had whole books of mathematical calculations.
Tell us, Doc.
Well, the earth used to revolve around the sun. The sun was 93 million miles from the earth.
Doc, why do you say used to? Why do you say was?
Well, because we suspected that a heavy enough blast of nuclear fission would throw the earth out of its orbit.
What's that, Doc?
Well, you take a rubber ball on a string, you swing it around in a circle. Now, that circle is its orbit. The string is the sun's attraction that keeps it moving evenly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I get it.
And then somebody comes up and hits the ball with a stick while it's going round and round.
Yes.
And what happens?
The ball flies off at a tangent.
That's right. Well, that's what's happened to the earth. The earth has left its orbit, children. And this explosion did it. Set it off like a rocket, in a way. And so we're all of us. We three and whoever's left, We're off on the biggest joyride that ever happened.
What's going to happen, Doc?
Well, the sun looks smaller and smaller to us, and the days will get progressively darker and colder.
Won't the earth ever come back, Doc?
Yes, it may. It may. Probably will. Won't be much use.
Why?
Because all the people, if any, will be frozen to death. And that, my dear children, is the reward of science. That's the big payoff. That's what happens as the end result of some caveman a couple of 100 million years ago discovering that 2 and 2 make 4.
What can we do?
Nothing.
But, Doc, can't you? I mean, you're a scientist. And...
A scientist, my dear, without his tools is just another man, a highly useless man.
Yeah.
But, Doc...
What, dear?
Do we have to die?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Why?
I just told you.
I know, but you could help.
Without my tools, without my papers, my books, my laboratory, without why, I haven't even got a pencil.
But you know so many things, Doc.
What?
Well, you know.
What? By golly, that's right. I do.
Why, of course.
I know. Say, I know how to keep us warm.
Well, you know lots
sure,
of things, Doc.
I know how we can survive for a while. We've got food.
Why, yeah, sure.
We can make tools.
Well, you just listen, Hal. If the real old caveman had to start from scratch and they had to learn everything, even 2 and 2 are 4, why, we cave people have a real life professor with us to show us all the shortcuts, Doc.
Why, Emily, you're wonderful.
Well, besides, Doc, if Adam and I are... Well, gee, Adam and Eve had children...
The dark days thus began. Daily the sun grew smaller, and daily the cold grew more and more bitter. In a month there was no daylight, only a kind of heavy twilight over all the gray prairie. The little sun was red and tired looking in the sky where the stars never stopped shining. Doc showed us how to make our cavern not comfortable, but livable. The cold grew more awful. We huddled together over our little fire, existing rather than living. We insulated the place, following Doc's directions. Once in a while, we went out into the dead world, faced the frightful cold for a minute or two, to look at the dwindling sun, to see if we still fled from it. We talked very, very little, for our very breath froze at our lips.
Doc, will we ever go back?
We've got to go back. All the laws of nature.
And time went on and on and on. And we knew that we three were all that the world held of living people. We were very close to death. And Doc still encouraged us.
No, a day will come. A day will come, Adam.
Oh, I'm so cold. Call me Adam.
A day will come. A day will come. It'll be the darkest day of them all. And that'll be the best day, Emily.
Why, Doc?
Why, that'll be the day when the earth reaches the end of this wild runaway ride. That'll be the day when we stop and start back.
Maybe we'll not be here to see it.
Oh, we will. And Adam, listen.
What? Are you comfortable, all right?
Okay. Well, Doc.
The day, the darkest day, that's the day I'm really going to start teaching you the things you'll need to know to survive. Because I'm older than you kids. I don't know how much longer I'll last. And I want to teach you and your children.
Pretty frightening, Doc.
Is anything frightening now, Emmy?
Nothing anymore, Doc.
A brand new world.
And Doc told us the secrets of the 9 planets. Sometimes we dared that frigid outside air to look up into the strange sky. It was always dark now. Nothing but the stars and the tiny, withered sun were above us. We saw Saturn's rings and the strange markings on Mars. We saw the Milky Way grow brighter and greater, the nebulas that Doc told us about. These we saw as no man has ever seen them. We suffered much, and we lived. We lived until that day when we could no longer find the sun in the sky, for all the sky was filled with stars, universes undreamed of. And our little sun was far away, and only another star among the billions. That day came, the darkest day the Doc had told us of. That was the day the Doc and I stood outside and saw our sun was lost. The darkest day. And we went back inside to Emily. While Emily slept, we talked.
Tomorrow? No, Adam. We won't see any change by one day. In another week, we should be able to see the sun again, to recognize it. And by another month, it'll be warmer. The sun will begin to get bigger. And in a few months...
It'll be longer than that, Doc. It took us a long time to get way out here.
But now we'll return faster, Adam. The sun's attraction, you see.
And then what becomes of us?
Well, there's so much to teach it.
What?
Oh, so many things.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, I'm almost afraid.
Afraid? Why?
Well, science did this to the Earth. Good night. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
No, Doc, let's talk some more.
I've got a lot of thinking to do, Adam. I promise you, I won't teach you anything that'll hurt you. Good night.
When I awoke, and Emily awoke, Doc was gone. I called his name. There wasn't any answer. Emily woke up and smiled at me. I got out and went to the door of the cave. I went on outside. I found Doc. Doc was lying there in the snow outside the door. And he'd open up his coat and just lay there. And there was a smile on his face, that quizzical, crooked smile I'd got to love so well. And there was a frozen sheet of paper in his hand. Doc had found a pencil somewhere. He'd written across the top of the sheet, "To Adam, for the darkest day." And as I picked it up, I discovered something. Across the snowbank where Doc lay, fell my shadow. I looked up, and there was the sun, a third as big as it used to be, but blinking cheerfully at me and the dead man in the snow. And as I stared, it seemed to grow bigger. I turned and went back into the cave where the paper Doc had left me. Emily, I said. Emily, Doc's dead. Doc left a note for me. I'm going to read it to you. Listen, Emily, I said, while I read it. Dear Adam and Emily, you make your own world without benefit of what I can teach you and your children. Because I'm a scientist, children, and I know too much. And I know I can't keep from teaching what I know. And the old world had all it needs of the things that come from knowing two and two make four. So good luck to you both. And to your children. That's all there was. But Doc, we didn't have any children. No, Doc. Not after the Earth got back where it belonged and we had a good look at those things that used to be fish. Those mutants, those changes you called them, remember? No, you were afraid to. The darkest day, you said, Doc. They're all dark now. Today's Quiet Please story is Adam and the Darkest Day. It was written and directed by Willis Cooper. The man who spoke to you was Ernest Chappell. And William Adams played Doc. Emily was Kathleen Cordell. As usual, music for Quiet Please is by Albert Berman. Now, for a word about next week, here is our writer-director, Willis Cooper.
Thank you for listening to Quiet Please. Next week, I have a story for you called The Evening and the Morning.
And so until next week at the same time, I'm quietly yours, Ernest Chappell. And now, a listening reminder. There's another dramatic adventure waiting for you on David Harding Counterspy this afternoon when this efficient law enforcement group becomes involved in the case of the senseless slayers. That's David Harding Counterspy. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
That's our sci-fi for this week. I'll be back next Monday with more. In the meantime, RelicRadio.com's got all the podcasts listed there. past episodes from them, links to our Facebook page, Twitter account, Shoutcast stream, forum, everything Relic Radio's at relicradio.com. Don't forget, if you'd like to help support the show, you can do so there as well. There's a donate button. Anything you're able to help us out with is greatly appreciated. You can email me at relicradio@gmail.com. Thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next week with a brand new episode of Relic Radio Science Fiction.